Welcome to Sustainability Bridges, a Eurosif podcast that aims to build bridges between policymakers, investors, academics, and civil society around the theme of sustainable investment. Eurosif, the European Sustainable Investment Forum, is the leading pan-European association promoting sustainable finance and investment at the European level. In these podcasts, Eurosif's Executive Director invites distinguished guests for a 30-minute conversation on current events shaping the sustainable investment community.
Hello everyone, my name is Aleksandra Palinska and I am the Executive Director of Eurosif, the European Sustainable Investment Forum. For this episode of Sustainability Bridges, I am honored to be joined by Ms. Lisa Hales, Director of International Shareholder Advocacy at Trillium Asset Management. Founded in 1982 and based in Boston, Massachusetts, Trillium has been at the forefront of ESG thought leadership and draws from decades of experience focused exclusively on responsible investing. Lisa has more than 20 years of experience advising institutional and individual investors on sustainable investing approaches in North America and Europe, and is a frequent speaker on gender equality and racial justice. Beyond her work with Trillium, Lisa is co-founder of the Racial Justice Investing Coalition and sits on the board of the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility. Together, we're going to discuss justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion investing. In particular, investing through the lens of anti-racism and building diversity and inclusion from a racial and ethnic origin perspective. We will also discuss the definition of climate justice and just transition, addressing and unpacking the challenging nature of language and framing, as well as the challenge of data collection given legal, regulatory, and operational requirements. Dear Lisa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Alexandra. Delighted to be here.
To start with, could you please tell us about your professional background in sustainable investments and your work at Trillium?
With pleasure. So I have the privilege of having worked in different parts of the sustainable investment industry. I worked for a national trade association in Canada, the Responsible Investment Association. I worked for a firm that did sustainable investment research on behalf of investors in London, IRIS, which is now part of Moody's. And for the last 10 years, I've worked for asset managers, so on the buy side. I currently work at Trillium Asset Management, where I've been for 3 years. And in my current role, as you said, I'm Director of International Shareholder Advocacy, which means I'm focused on engaging with companies which are listed outside of the United States on their social and environmental impacts and trying to get them to address some of their performance gaps.
Great, thank you. You're also co-founder of the Racial Justice Investing Coalition. Could you tell us more about this initiative and its mission?
Happily. RJI came about almost seven years ago, I believe. I was attending a conference that was organized by the USCIF here in the US. There is a panel discussion on mass incarceration, but there was no mention of race during that panel discussion, which struck me and some of the other attendees as a glaring gap. And subsequent to that, there was some research done on sustainable mutual funds here in the US and an analysis of the staff who actually manage and run those funds. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the research found that the demographic makeup of those funds was pretty similar to the demographics of the wider investment community. So very white and mostly male. And so a group of us came together to brainstorm about what we could do about these facts on the ground that we thought, frankly, were unacceptable for an industry that prides itself on addressing social and environmental challenges. And out of that, RJI was born. It's a group of volunteers who arrange networking and learning opportunities. There's a monthly webinar series. There is a number of working groups that work on different elements to do with racial justice investing. And the purpose really is just to serve as a node, a learning community for investors, both asset owners and investment managers. And there's also some advocacy groups which are part of it, to come together and really wrestle with what it means to invest with a racial equity or racial justice lens. I think we're all together on this learning journey. No one has definitively figured it out. And so the idea is we provide mutual support, education, networking, learning. And I continue to kind of attend events, though I'm no longer part of the leadership group. We've passed that on. We also have a coordinator who's in place now, a part-time coordinator. And so it's kind of becoming a little bit more institutionalized and established. There's about 400 active members, I think, of the group right now.
Thank you. Sounds really great. How would you define climate justice and what it means to promote climate justice through investments?
Now, that is such an important question. Climate justice for me is connecting the climate crisis to the social, racial, and environmental issues in which it's deeply embedded. It recognizes that climate change has disproportionate impacts on low-income and communities of color around the world, and those communities and folks are the least able typically to influence the responses to the problem. So much like the oil and gas industry has incredibly negative impacts on communities where production takes place, if we're thinking about the transition to a lower carbon economy, the minerals, materials that we need in order to power that transition, we have to ensure that the communities from which those minerals and materials are extracted are not left worse off. You know, they shouldn't pay the highest price in order for our economy to transition. So fundamentally, it's about embedding concern for all stakeholders in our understanding of the, you know, there's important investment opportunities that are available to us as part of the transition, but we also have to keep in mind this idea of the most vulnerable and our responsibility towards them in ensuring they're protected during this transition.
Thank you. These are indeed very important insights. Could you please elaborate on the importance of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, the so-called JEDI, and how can we promote JEDI through investments?
Yeah, so obviously here in the United States and to some extent around the world, in the aftermath of the social justice protests in 2020, the murder of George Floyd, a huge amount of energy and attention was directed to the idea of racial equity and racial justice. And the Racial Justice Investing Coalition actually put out a statement that 140 investors signed during that period of protest, which had a number of commitments that we asked investors to make. And I think, or they're aspirational commitments. And I think one of the challenges in the environment we're in now, where we see this significant backlash growing in the United States, is keeping focused on, why we were concerned about these issues in the first place, recognizing that a lot of the backlash is, cynical and self-serving, that it's not a mistake or by chance that much of the backlash is focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and criticisms of woke capitalism, quote unquote. There are deliberate, intentional movements who are trying to undermine the important steps we must take to create a more fair, a more just world. And as part of our investment approach, the pushback has been fairly successful at scaring some of the largest asset managers. I think, for example, I can point to we at Trillium, we file a lot of shareholder proposals here in the United States. We filed several on the issue of climate, for example, around ending financing for fossil fuels. Despite the fact that we have made those proposals less prescriptive in this year versus last year, support for that type of proposal went down in this, you know, proxy voting season. And I think that's an indication of anxiety and fear that's being generated amongst asset managers, some of the largest asset managers. I mean, Trillium is a fairly small asset manager. We are very well known for our, how can I put it, our forthrightness, our willingness to be out in front on a number of issues. And I think that's part of what attracts our clients to work with us. And so in a sense, when you become a Trillium client, you know that there's going to be a very activist stance on any number of issues, whether it be human rights, climate change, labor issues. So we have the privilege of being free to say and do things that maybe some of the very, very large asset managers who have a multitude of clients and are trying to satisfy, a very broad client base, we don't necessarily have those types of constraints. I do think, though, that ultimately this type of, you know, it's understandable that the first response is to kind of retreat and try and keep your head down out of anxiety and a little bit of fear. But I think ultimately, asset managers, whatever their size, will have to be very clear on what issues they will stand up for. You know, it's like you have to stand up for something or you'll fall for anything. And I think getting clear and getting very intentional about like the issues that are salient to their investment performance, climate change is definitely a huge one, cannot be ignored, cannot be... you know, there may be a variety of strategies you will pursue, but ultimately, this is a real issue. I will just mention that during the ESG hearings that have been taking place over the past month, there was a representative from the American, I believe it was the American Enterprise Institute, who asserted that A, the science on climate change is still up for debate, and B, that there is not a climate crisis. So, I mean, I wasn't in the room. I can't imagine how anyone could keep a straight face and make those assertions. But I think these are the last throes of resistance. So they'll be very, very desperate and in some ways vicious, because the opponents to both addressing climate change and a just transition are fighting tooth and nail to try and hang on to the last little bits of power and influence. So I mentioned that example as one that I think maybe 10 years ago there would have been more support for that position. I think even the Republican senators and Congress people in the room likely rolled their eyes internally, if not publicly, at that kind of comment. I actually, you know, being in this role, I can only be optimistic. I see every day in my work directly with companies, you know, companies are not monolithic. They have people inside them who are working on supply chain oversight and environmental and reducing plastic use and improving energy efficiency. So those are our natural allies. We're working collaboratively with the companies that we own in order to encourage them to shift a little faster, be a little bit more ambitious. And we want to make common cause with other investors who share that view.
Thank you. And this is really great stuff. And, you know, I think what should be a source of inspiration to other asset managers across the world. Speaking a little bit more about JEDI investments, what does it mean in practice? How to actually, you know, make it work? How can we improve justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion through investments? And what are its benefits to investee companies and investors?
Yeah, so I think for me, there's probably two parts to that. The operationalizing of JEDI investments. So the first part is actually turning the lens on ourselves as an investment institution. So what are the blind spots that we have? What kind of diversity do we have internally? Trillium underwent our own racial equity audit over the past year, and now we're kind of in the first year of implementation, which has involved expanding our internship program and being much more intentional about how we recruit new employees and thinking about pathways for promote. I mean, we're a very small firm, but we have less than 50 employees, but we also recognize that we have opportunities. We buy, you know, we have suppliers, we have employees, we have relationships, we have opportunities to bring a racial justice lens to all our commercial interactions. So that's one part of it, just as an organization. And then I think as an investment firm, we have been thinking, the investment team and the advocacy team have been working collaboratively around what does it mean to look with a racial equity or a racial justice lens at our portfolio. We have long avoided investing in companies who had controversies around discriminatory practices, for example. And a very good example of that is redlining here in the United States by banks, where banks either refuse to lend or lend at much lower rates in communities that are largely communities of color. That's actually illegal, and there are regulations that are designed to prevent that from happening, and yet there are examples of that, as well as disproportionate treatment of clients depending on their racial background. And I think clearly, from the point of view of an investment firm and the companies themselves, it makes no sense to treat clients differently based on their racial background. It actually is inimical to the long-term success of the firm. So if we move to think about, like, why is this good for companies? Removing bias, removing discrimination, creating systems that are merit-based, truly merit-based, is actually hugely beneficial, both to the company's long-term performance, to morale, and to the sense of engagement from employees. If employees believe that everybody gets a fair shake, then they're more likely to be kind of committed. Retention goes up, turnover goes down. So those are the kinds of business reasons that we think it's important to apply that type of lens. And I think, you know, in addition to us kind of avoiding companies that have controversies, or, you know, we don't invest in companies that are connected to the private prison industry, for example, and in addition to companies that have patterns of controversies around discriminatory behavior. But I think the harder thing is really getting to, as an investor, as a wealth holder, we are deeply embedded and implicated in a system that is based on racism. And that's a much harder nut to crack. So when we think about, like, how is wealth accumulated? How was wealth accumulated? Who holds wealth? And what does it mean to try and address some of the harms that have been caused by the deployment of this wealth? So I think, you know, our standard advocacy approach, which is really looking at, you know, things like climate justice and human rights, like, we haven't necessarily thought of our human rights work as having a racial justice lens, but in fact, there is a racial justice aspect to the work we've done on behalf of workers in supply chains who are often women and people of color. So if we're looking to improve living wages, if we're looking for enhancing worker voice, if we're looking to ensure that there are worker representatives, labor representation that can negotiate with companies, that's actually an element of racial justice as well, even though we haven't explicitly necessarily called it that in the past. And I think part of our work is to really make more explicit the racial implications of our investment strategy. So I think here in the US, there's a very clear, I don't even want to say a clear history, but there have been laws and regulations specifically designed to reinforce a system of racial segregation and racial mistreatment. When we go overseas, the international market, Europe, for example, I mean, let's just say that racial discrimination is a global phenomenon, but of course it manifests itself and it's a different conversation in other parts of the world, which we as a US investor must take into account. We can't simply assume that our approach is meaningful or sensible in other markets. And In fact, that's why this work that EuroCIF is sponsoring is so important, is so necessary. As an investor who's really interested in the question of racial equity and racial justice and wants to have a consistent approach on a global basis, I want to communicate and network and understand how investors who are located in other parts of the world are thinking about these issues and what the context is for talking about these issues, or even what the, what kind of disclosure is available. And I think there are many layers to that that are likely to be unpicked over the course of this, or the course of this year, I hope.
Great. Thank you so much. Indeed, I think we're very pleased to start this new work stream and, support development of a community of practice, looking at the how to promote GenAI through the investments. Indeed, as you mentioned, I think US has a very kind of a specific history, and also I think especially Trillium, as you describe, has really great experiences actually in tackling those challenges actually that you described. What would be your recommendations for the Europe-based actually investors and asset managers who may have less experiences to that end? What are the aspects, to kind of watch out for? And I think you described, some of the, first steps and things to look into. But yeah, what would you be, in your view, kind of, some recommendations and starting points for European asset managers, investors that can learn from you?
Well, I hope to learn from them too. So I think, meaningful differences obviously do exist between the US and Europe. But I think there's some commonalities in terms of challenges that investors face that we can have as a shared starting point. And I think one of them is really to understand a little bit more of the history. I think, America's history with slavery and subsequently Jim Crow, which was a set of laws that kind of reinforced racial hierarchies here. Europe does not have that history, but of course it has a colonial history. It has an imperial history in often cases, and it has a history of migration from its former colonies and more recent migration as well. And as a result, there are communities, often communities of color, which are clearly not integrated into, don't have access and do not seem to have the same opportunities as the native-born population. And I think even the language that we use to talk about it, Europe is not a monolithic place. We can't talk about a single European approach, but what we might talk about is how different regions of Europe and have a different context, a different history. And I, and along with my European peers, hope to learn more about what is the discussion that happens around integration, anti-racism in Northern Europe versus Southern Europe, in the Benelux countries versus France. And we've seen, in France relatively recently, huge numbers of protests and riots as a result of a young teenage boy being killed by the police. So it's not that it's not dissimilar from essentially the protests that kicked off George Floyd's murder, or rather the protests that were, that resulted after George Floyd's murder, as well as some other police killings, unjustified police killings here in the United States. So I think, we can see that there might be some similarities. There also are very significant differences. So we can't make a like for like comparison, but what we can say is, given this situation, how do stakeholders relate to these issues? How are companies thinking about these issues in terms of their own workforce? I know, for example, that the millennial cohort and the Gen Zs, who are right behind the millennials, they're one of the most, at least in the United States, they're one of the most diverse populations of, you know, potential employees. And they have very different expectations and understanding of, they have very high expectations, right, frankly, around fairness, equity, and inclusion. And I know there's, you know, there's some stats which say that, you know, some huge proportion of them would not be interested in working for an employer that did not have, you know, a robust diversity, equity, and inclusion program. So I think there's an opportunity there for all of us as investors to say, hey, let's figure out together what best practice looks like and then talk to companies in our portfolios about like where they are on that spectrum. I know there are European companies who are fairly advanced on these topics. You know, they're global. They've been operating in many different jurisdictions. They have, you know, introduced and run successful programs on a you know, on different continents. So I think we can learn from that. And what I'm interested in doing along with other investors is really figuring out good examples of best practice and how we can socialize and essentially spread those examples so that they become not just best practice, but common practice.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. In your view, what are the main challenges preventing the wider adoption of the JEDI lens in investments and investment processes? How can investment allocators around the world better integrate a gender and JEDI lens in internal processes, teams, and within portfolios? And are there any regulatory or data collection barriers?
So I think to answer the first part of your question, what are the barriers? I think I often say this about a whole range of things, but incentives. What are the incentives that investment managers are given? And if the incentives are not aligned with the outcomes that their clients are seeking, then it's unlikely that they will obtain those outcomes. So I guess part of my comment is directed at asset owners to say you need to be very clear. And I think there's work going on around this issue, around asset owner expectations and changing, you know, kind of mandates and how asset managers are evaluated. Because if you really care about the implementation of a JEDI lens, if you're concerned, I mean, there is a mismatch. I won't deny it, Alexandra. There is a mismatch because what we're talking about is a systemic risk. It's a challenge that you can't diversify away. And yet it's a very long-term risk. So individual investment managers and asset owners may have a mismatch in terms of the outcomes they're seeking. An asset owner, a very large one, even moderately sized ones, they own the market. They can't really hide from these systemic risks. If you have an active manager as an employee, they could potentially say, well, you know, we'll just avoid the worst part of it and we'll try and build a portfolio that. But ultimately, you know, I don't believe you can hide from these types of systemic risks, whether it be racism or economic inequality. These are things that are in our interest to work together to eradicate. And investors do have a role, can play a role. I think that's, you know, if anyone watching this takes one thing away, this is what I want them to think about. Investors can and should play a role in addressing these systemic challenges. We can no longer say, you know, that's not part of our role or that's not our job. That doesn't fly any longer. So that's the broad thing I would say. And then in terms of, you know, barriers to data collection, you know, here in the United States, we are, I don't want to say blessed, but we have something called the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which is a federal agency, which every company that has more than 100 employees is required to report on the demographic makeup of their workforce. And not until quite recently, that was not, you didn't have to publish that information. You had to share it with the EOC. But one of the things that Trillium has done alongside other firms has made requests to companies to make that information public, to share the demographic information, because that provides us with a benchmark. We can see kind of snapshot of your employees today and then look 5 years out, what's changed? Have you actually improved the representation of underrepresented groups? Some of the firms that have been most forward in this area have been tech firms who have been publishing this information for probably 8 or 9 years now. Now, one of the things I will say is that publishing the information is the first step, because what we've seen in the tech firms is that the numbers haven't shifted much. So it's great that they're being more transparent, and we also need intentional strategies and pressure from investors and other stakeholders to keep them kind of focused on improving their performance on that issue. In the EU, I know that it's for a variety of reasons, for historical reasons and cultural reasons, collecting demographic information on employees can either be very difficult to almost, I think even considered illegal in certain parts. I'm not an expert, but I think there are ways to collect information that's consistent with the GDPR. And I think those ways include essentially being very clear as to why you're collecting that information, ensuring that it remains anonymous, and then, you know, destroying the information as soon as you no longer need it. And I think there's an opportunity for companies to engage their employees to explain, we want to collect this information because we want to create a fairer, more transparent, more meritocratic-based company. We want to understand, you know, the makeup of our employees so we can see, you know, are there fewer women in senior management because we don't have the right, you know, supports for employees who may have caregiving responsibilities? Have we failed to reach out, you know, to retain employees from particular racial or ethnic backgrounds because we don't have an inclusive culture? These are the kinds of questions that this data could help companies solve wherever they're based. And so I think it's definitely doable. There's already some European companies which are collecting this type of information. So despite the worry about it might breach European regulations, I think there is a way to do it that is completely consistent and legal and can serve, it can benefit the company's kind of approach to employee engagement.
Thank you, Lisa. Very insightful. In recent years, policymakers and financial industry participants have been paying increasing attention to scaling up finance in support of the transition to a more climate-friendly, sustainable economy. How can we improve awareness about the importance of climate justice and investing through the JEDI lens? And how can we make sure that this cause moves higher up on the agendas of financial institutions and policymakers?
So I think podcasts like this are part of the solution. It is, you know, it's education, education, and more education. It's really continuing to insist on the importance of an approach, an investment approach that really does have all stakeholders at the heart of it. So investment professionals are often, you know, they can be blinkered because their role is to, you know, value companies and allocate capital, make investment decisions. Here we come along with our ESG data and our requests for sustainable and impact approaches. And we have definitely complicated their jobs. But again, as I say, we've gone way beyond the point of that's not my job anymore. Now we're at the point of how do we create the pathways and the processes that embed this and make it kind of automatic almost. That is, I think we're still a ways away from that, but we are maybe at the end of the beginning. So the end of the beginning is that despite the ESG backlash, I think there's clearly an understanding that many, many issues are highly relevant to the long-term financial performance, cannot be ignored, are important for investors to take into account. So we've kind of gotten over that hurdle. The next hurdle is the embedding of, I think, what I would call the stakeholder primacy, not the shareholder primacy. So the importance of ensuring that all stakeholders, particularly the most vulnerable, are considered. that would imply, for example, that there are some projects that should not be funded, which, you know, I remember having a conversation with a portfolio manager who said to me, well, do you mean we wouldn't invest in that? I'm like, exactly. Exactly. And that, you know, that ties into the incentives. If you want to ensure that we have a JEDI lens as part of our investment approach, then asset owners and other types of clients need to communicate that, and need to acknowledge that that means that the return profile may shift, and that, you know, that they've got to be okay with that. So we're really challenging the kind of narrowness of fiduciary responsibility or fiduciary duty. And I know that there's work going on in the UK right now to re-examine fiduciary duty. But I also think in Europe, at least, I'm not an expert on this, but I understand that there's always been a slightly more expansive, or at least not as narrow a view as exists in the United States. So I think there's an opportunity there that European asset managers who have European clients may have a little bit more leeway to say, you know, we have these dual objectives that we're trying to pursue. And if that can be, for example, written into mandates, written into contracts, part of the expectations of what investment managers do, that's where you see like the permanent shift in how we invest.
Thank you, Lisa. And actually, maybe on the last point, you know, of I would say the risk and return profile. In a way, you know, I remember in the last years, I've been also looking into the kind of a correlation between sustainability considerations. I mean, integrating, for instance, sustainability risks and considering the impacts and the returns. And at the end of the day, you know, I would say different studies show different results. And I think this is definitely an area in which we need much more independent research. And also, I think this is a fast evolving, you know, area. But I would say there has been already quite a bit of also research and studies demonstrating that, especially in terms of incorporation of sustainability risks. I mean, this is, you know, basically just considering, yes, and integrating certain sustainability aspects in a pure risk management. At the end of the day, this can even improve the mid to long-term performance. And I would think and argue that there should be a positive correlation between actually returns and actually improved justice, equity, and inclusion, especially mid to long term, right? Because, I mean, if you think even about diversity on boards, management within the companies, I think, you know, it's very enriching, right? I mean, to ensure that you have different perspectives and even the aspects you mentioned about also ensuring we can, you know, retain valuable employees, foster inclusive and positive corporate culture. I think at the end of the day, this is something that can definitely even improve corporate performance longer term.
I think absolutely that's true. I think those of us who've worked in this field for a long time, we are used to using or used to hearing this, the win-win argument, that you do good and you can do good and you can do well. I guess what I'm saying is, I think that's true for some issues. I think that though, I guess what I would say is, even if that wasn't true, we should still pursue justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. So we don't need it to be financially performative in order for us to pursue this. In fact, there's a justice-based argument that, in my mind, is more compelling. But I understand for investors, it's often important to make the business case.
On this positive and important note, I would like to thank you, Lisa, for joining us today and for this insightful conversation.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you, Alexandra.